I always sort of used golf as the escape from dealing with stuff. But it was actually on the golf courses where I did the majority of my thinking, right? So all of those times I was in therapy and my therapist would say, when you're thinking about these sorts of things, try and process it in this way or whatever it might have been, whatever thing. That was what I was doing when I was out on the golf course because I was alone with my thoughts. I couldn't escape what had happened to me. I couldn't just think about something different. Your brain don't work that way, does it?
Hi, and welcome to the Golf Yourself Healthy podcast, where deep, meaningful, and philosophical conversations about golf and life are par for the course. I'm your host, Chris Lynch. I'd like to offer you a warm welcome, whether you're a returning GYH podcast listener, or if this is the first time you're tuning in for an episode. In this episode 2, I'm in conversation with my longtime friend and fellow avid golfer, Ben Seabrook. In our conversation, Ben openly, honestly, and vulnerably shares his experience of golfing himself through grief following the sudden and traumatic loss of his son Dylan, who was born sleeping in 2012. Ben talks about his love, respect, and admiration for his wife Bryony, who has worked tirelessly in recent years to raise much-needed awareness around the subject of baby loss, and through her efforts, has raised several tens of thousands of pounds through fundraising events for Tommy's, a leading charity which supports families all over the UK who have been affected by baby loss. Ben talks about how golf runs in the family. He owes his own introduction to the game to his brother Matt, who was working in the golf industry at the time. And looking ahead to the next generation of golfer from the Seabrook family, Ben's 8-year-old son Jensen has also recently taken up the game. Ben and I recorded this episode on site at Royal Norwich Golf Club after an early morning round of golf on a cracking golf course, followed by some delicious lunch in the modern and progressive clubhouse. I hope you enjoy listening to my conversation with Ben. A word of warning, if you're a Man City fan or you're from Skegness, you might find this episode a little bit triggering. Also, I'd love to know from you, our listeners, where you stand on the saying, speaking your truth versus speaking the truth. All shall be revealed if you stick around and listen to the full episode. Please don't forget to leave a review on this episode or the show itself on whichever podcast platform you're listening on. Your ratings and feedback will not only help this podcast expand its reach and get the word out to the masses that golf is good for you, but the feedback and comments you offer will also help us to continually enhance the show for your enjoyment and listening pleasure. If you know of anyone who you think would enjoy the show, please share the link with them. And don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Instagram at Golf Yourself Healthy and X at GYH Pod. Oh, and finally, always remember to embrace the rough and forever cherish the fairway. Welcome to Golf Yourself Healthy. You are the first guest that has ever featured on this podcast. To mark that occasion, I feel I should have brought like a big confetti gun or something and celebrated you like a supermarket celebrates their like millionth customer or something. But I've, alas, I haven't done that. But how does it feel to be the first guest on this podcast?
An honour and a privilege, I would say. I feel very, I think it's a fantastic idea you've got to talk about this sort of stuff. So yeah, I feel very privileged to be able to be your first official guest. I mean, to be honest with you, what you could potentially do is wait. And then if you get a better guest, you can demote me if you need to. But...
just delay this episode. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Right.
And no. Then we can edit this bit out. It's not a problem.
No. We'll start off with a bang. And I'm grateful that you've agreed to come and be on the podcast. So for our listeners, just like Ben and I are joining you from Royal Norwich Golf Club, where we're sat in the rather swish chairman's office, I think this is called.
Yes, okay. I think it's just called that. I don't think the chairman
actually resides in here, yeah. And does his or her work in here. But we've just enjoyed a great round of golf here today. It's been quite an eventful day to get here, I would say. I drove across from Wales yesterday evening, and we got up early this morning to get over here for the first tee of the day. Mm-hmm. But I had a bit of a calamity when we woke up this morning and realized that I'd traveled all the way from Wales with one set of underpants. So I had to make sure that we could do a little detour via Tesco Extra on the way to get some underpants and also contact lens solution that I'd forgotten as well. But
which you then subsequently left in the car, so had no pants on after you'd showered after the round.
That's right, absolutely, yeah. So I forgot my pants, not once, but twice, but Ben saved me, so he went back out from the changing rooms to the car and got the clean pants in, so I am wearing clean pants for this episode. But
maybe not for some of the other episodes.
Optional. We'll see. We'll see how it goes. See how I feel for each episode. Should we spend just maybe a couple of minutes talking about Royal Norwich Golf Club? Because I guess in the context of Golf Yourself Healthy, really a big part of this is around making this game more diverse and inclusive. And certainly if I can reflect on my experience of having been here today and some of the things that I've observed and experienced. So I knew coming here, for example, that they have genderless golf tees. And I kind of was quite curious about that and wasn't sure what that would mean in practice. But I mean, can you say a bit about how that worked?
Yeah, I mean, they have five tees. Obviously not in the winter, they have three in the winter, but in the summer months, they have five tees. You have the very back tees, which kind of like championship tees. I don't even think they really play the competitions off those far back ones, the general competitions. They might play like the summer champs and things like that off there. But the you then have, I can't remember the colours of them, but rather than having white, yellow, red, and then the reds always being denominated as the ladies' tees, you can literally come around here and play whichever tee you want, whatever sex you are, however old you are as well. So I think if you looked at it, you would say your forward tees are obviously your junior tees and then all that kind of stuff. But there's some quite talented female golfers here, which I'm sure play off some of the further back tees for the challenge. But yeah. I like it because I tend to play quite a lot in the evenings, as you know, right? So if I'm coming out after work, sometimes I think to myself, I've only really got an hour and a half before it gets dark. Actually, I can make it a bit quicker for myself if I'm playing off those forward tees. So I'm hitting a long iron or driver and then a very short iron in rather than hitting driver, long iron, all that kind of stuff. Just makes the game quicker. So I think it's quite... I mean, it doesn't feel like it should be progressive, but I suppose from a golfing perspective, it probably is quite progressive that you would have that optionality, which is good.
Yeah, and I think, you know, so other things that I've noticed, were pointed out to me. So the pair of us went out and played and we were joined by another member, Gareth. Mm-hmm. And so Gareth, if you're listening to this, thank you very much for your company today. We had a really pleasant round and a good laugh over lunch afterwards. But he pointed out to me as well that... Historically, what you would see in golf clubs and in clubhouses and things is, I would say, a certain degree of pomp around the plaques and things that are on the walls in terms of who's won what tournament and mm-hmm. things like that. And I think what they still maintain that to an element here, but it's kind of, I'm not sure what we just saw coming up the stairs here, you've got like it does denote the presidents and the captains and things, but it's that isn't so present here. And I think what they seem to have achieved is there's a balance of modernity and tradition.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of describing what they've managed to do here. And I think they're, as I said, it's quite a progressive golf club to be involved in. And when you see some of the stuff that they're thinking and doing and planning and doing, and as we talked about, they've put in a paddleboard court here. I think it's quite big in Spain, isn't it? Where it's like a cross between tennis and
squash.
Because it's got the walls on the side.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's probably not. I don't know of any other places in and around Norfolk that have thought to try that. So I think it's looking at trying to encourage different types of people to come in, different people with different interests to come into a golf club, which is good because the other thing is the restaurant down here is excellent. So they often do lots of like themed food nights or wine tastings and stuff like that, which just gets more people that would naturally come to a golf club involved.
I could be wrong, but having what I've just seen downstairs is I sense there are people that are in here just to eat and not necessarily, they're not golfers, you know, or they might golf, but they've come in here for a social occasion or whatever, which I think is a good sign. So if we sort of, let's move on to chatting a bit about your golf, your relationship with golf. How did it all begin?
Beginnings in golf, I suppose, would actually probably have come from my brother, Matt. He worked in a golf club in a place near where I grew up in Esher, Moor Place, it was called. It was a little nine-hole public course, which wasn't very long, wasn't very pretty. That's where I started. I had a few lessons there when I was probably 8 or 9 years old, I suppose. And I did enjoy it, but I think my lessons were happening in the winter, which kind of meant that I didn't continue them. So I would play on and off, and I was quite a sporty kid, I suppose. So I played a lot of football. I played quite a lot of cricket. I even had a season playing rugby. And then golf was always kind of a drop-in, drop-out of type approach. And then I played it again, I would say on and off throughout my 20s, but was mainly playing football and over the most of the months I was there. But I'd always wanted to get more involved in golf. But where I was growing up and where I was living at the time, it's a very expensive sport to get involved in. And then we moved to Norfolk 12 years ago. And one of the things I said to my wife at the time was, when we move up here, I want to join a golf club. It's much more affordable around here. I want to be able to play golf at least once a week. So I was starting to get to the point where I was going to finish playing football. And I felt like I needed something to basically get me out of the house and give me something to focus on, because I'd had that constant of playing football all the way from five or six up until I was, well, when I finished playing, when I was about 32, 33. So that's where I really started to get more into my golf when we moved to Norfolk. Joined a course not too far away from here called Wentham Valley, which was just around the corner from where we were living at the time. Not the best course, not the best club, I would say. It was more of a cheap resort course, I would say. But it was quite easy just to rock up. It was never that busy, so you could just rock up and play whenever you wanted, which is good for me because in the evenings, I don't like doing the first tee time normally, so you should feel privileged that I sorted that for us. Just because I don't like the course being busy, because I like to be able to come out and just relax and do my own thing. You know, if I'm struggling with a specific type of shot, I want to be able to chuck another ball down and have another hit at it. And then when you come and play in the evenings, usually there's not really many people around for you to for that to worry. But that was certainly my kind of beginnings. I would have to thank my brother for getting me involved to start with. And obviously we play a fair bit. I haven't played for a little while with him, but we do play a fair bit normally.
Well, yeah, like you say, I do know your brother, Matt, and we've, well, you, me and him have known each other for a number of years now, and we'll get on to that shortly. But yeah, there's something I didn't know about him, that he worked in a golf club. But so I think you touched on something there. I get the impression that golf for you, or where you seem to feel most relaxed playing it, is playing it on your own or going out.
So yes, I do enjoy playing with the guys, but actually I prefer doing that on a concentrated basis, I would say. So when we go away for a weekend or I have a golf trip with the boys, that's when I have the most fun, when I'm playing with others. But other than that, I like the solitary confinement of being a golfer on my own, basically in an evening, and just being alone with my thoughts and listening to a podcast as I go around, or, you know, maybe sometimes I listen to a bit of music with my headphones in and that kind of thing, just to kind of take me away from the general noise that's there.
I can say, I mean, I'm with you, and my enjoyment at golf, certainly, or the arenas in which I enjoy playing golf, are certainly on my own, but never had headphones in and listened to stuff before. Do you not find that interferes with your swing thoughts or your...
That's probably not a bad thing. Let's be honest, how many times have we stood over a ball and thought, Christ, I don't know what I'm doing here.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I'm set up right. I did it today.
But actually today you stepped away from the...
That time.
But anyway,
the 15 other times in the round I didn't, and I hit a terrible shot afterwards, right? There are times where I like to be just in silence and just listening to nature, and it helps me feel a bit grounded. I think if I'm walking around in an evening, I'm appreciating the environment that I'm in, because golf courses are beautiful places as well, right? Like if you go out and look at, when you play decent ones or when you play half decent ones, visually they're very pretty, right? And sometimes I like to be able to take stock of and think, Christ, look where I am, like in a wonderful place. There's birds singing, the sun's going down or whatever it might be. It looks incredible around here. So sometimes I like to not have anything in my ear, but I often find that I can overthink my golf when I'm not distracted, if that makes sense.
So yeah.
I like having, like, I listen to a lot of comedy podcasts and things like that, which help me just sort of mosey around my round.
Well, you talk there about overthinking your golf, and actually what I've enjoyed about today is I have a tendency often when I'm playing at a new course, especially, I will research the course within an inch of its life before I arrive there. So I've mapped out the stroke index, where my shots are being gained and lost, and like I've already decided, I've kind of mapped out what I want the first hole to look like in terms where I'm going to hit it. And I mean, more often than not, it doesn't end up that way. But I've not even planned beyond the first hole. That's the trouble, you know? But I think I do obsess about, I don't know. So today, for example, having not played golf in, or this is the first round that I've played in quite a number of months now, I guess what I liked was we turned up here quite casual and quite relaxed, which I think really actually helped me. Because the other thing as well is, when I'm coming along and already thinking about, we're doing this podcast today and it's one of the early episodes and I've got a bit of anxiety about that and things. And also I can find it awkward going out with randoms.
Yeah, sure.
But again, the guy that we went out today with, happened to be a really decent guy.
Yeah, yeah.
But I must admit, like, I've not always had that experience when you get paired up and it's like, it's a bit small talk and it's kind of, yeah, I mean, standing over that first tee today, really all I was just thinking was just enjoy this, commit to this shot, commit to every shot, don't overthink it, and just wherever the ball goes, keep an eye on it, find it, go up, hit it, and keep going. So do you find similar when you're playing your golf? Are you quite a thinker when you...
Yeah, I don't like to try and analyse my golf a huge amount. I want to try and understand what I'm doing wrong. I think some of the... Because I play quite a lot on my own, I can... Like, if I don't hit decent drives, for example, right, I know that if I'm not going to hit decent drives early on in the round, I'm going to struggle for the rest of the round. So if I don't hit my first drive how I want it, if I'm playing in anything that's remotely competitive, so even if it's a weekend away with the boys where there's a bit of money on the line or whatever it might be, right?
Yeah.
If I hit my first two drives poorly, I won't get my driver out of my bag again. I have to get to a point where I just won't just persist with poor shot after poor shot.
Mm.
Whereas when I'm on my own, I'm thinking, I need to keep hitting this till I get it right. And at that point, it then becomes not about my round and how I'm scoring. It becomes around, what am I actually learning about what I'm doing? What's the feeling of why I'm hitting this wrong? Am I casting over the top? Am I too closed on the way down? Or whatever it might be, that's where my head's at. So I'm not thinking about kind of the overall round. I'm thinking about that next shot is the thing that I need to think, okay, or not necessarily the next shot, the same shot, put another ball down, try and do it properly this time. So I think that's kind of how I get round my round of golf. I'm just taking it kind of one bit at a time.
Mm. You definitely helped me today, though, with there was an occasion, I don't know if you remember, where I just flubbed a chip and I was about to walk up and hit it almost instantly with the same club. And you were like, you don't want that club.
Go change it.
Get the granddad chipper out and get the hybrid. And then sure enough,
stuck it
like a gimme. So... But it does suggest to me that you're very conscious of and in touch with kind of these things, like the mental side of golf. I mean, without being too philosophical
So,
you know,
I think it's also about recognizing where you've got strengths and where you've got weaknesses, right? I know that I struggle if I'm chipping around the green and I've got a bit rough in the way of me. I know that I can often, if I've got too lofted a club, I can duff the chip. So more often than not, I'm much better off getting an 8 iron or 9 iron and just playing a putting stroke and just bumping it up, letting it run out. Mm. And that's what I would, rather than trying to fly something all the way to the hole, I just don't need to do that.
No.
And the amount of times I've got myself into that situation where I've hit a poor one and then gone to hit, the lie has completely changed, right? So I'm out of the rough, I'm on the fringe, I'm annoyed that I've only just made it to the fringe, and I think to myself, I'll just hit it. And I'm like, well, no, what are you doing? You don't just hit it, you need to step away a little bit.
Yeah.
Is this the right club to be hitting this next shot? No, actually, I don't need it. I can get my granddad chipper out and hit my little, just play a putting stroke with my hybrid. And
play the percentages, basically.
Yeah.
Don't try and play the hero shots.
Yeah. You know,
don't try and be a hero.
I won't lie. There are times when I do like playing the hero shots. Like I play with another lad here, Steve, and we always joke about playing a floppy doppy doodah, like a Phil Mickelson style flop, right?
Yeah.
So I always try those. Occasionally they come off. Mm. Sometimes I scull them through the back of the green.
There were a few occasions today where you gave me on-course commentary of the thought pros. I'm going to thread this thing right between these two bunkers. But, you know, I just let you go through your process and I enjoyed it. You know, it was good.
You've got to be confident with this.
You do, you do. So, right, we've talked a bit about, we both have an enjoyment of solitary confinement and playing golf on our own, but I think let's tell the story to the listener of how you and I met. And so do you want to talk a bit about, introduce the golf tournament that we met at?
Yes. So, I mean, this started quite humble beginnings, I would say. So I think there were only 12 of us that originally went on this. So a bunch of lads that I used to play football with when I was a younger man, I would say. We stopped playing football together. We all went...
Still a fairly young man, aren't you? I mean, how old are you now?
41.
41?
Yes, old enough.
All right.
When we finished playing football, we still wanted to be able to go out and catch up and do stuff. And these are guys that I've known since I was sort of 16 years old, right? So I've known them for an awfully long time. And we played golf casually, I would say. But we thought, our friend Alan decided to set up a tournament, which was kind of like a Ryder Cup format, which we played in probably one of the crappiest courses I've ever played in in the UK, in a place called Crettenham in Crettingham in Suffolk. Which was great for me because it was like an hour away from my house. But where I grew up, all of those boys are based in Surrey. So a bit more of a trek for them. But we set that up and there was 12 of us, I think, the first year. Crappy lodges, rubbish clubhouse. Food was all right. I think this is where were you there when we did the boys would go and get the doner kebab pizzas?
Yeah, I think I must have come a lot. What year did it start? Do you remember? I feel like I came along to what was the second or third iteration.
It'll be 10 years this year, wouldn't it? Yeah. So it'll be 2014.
I feel I was around at least for one of the doner kebab pizzas.
Yeah, you must have been. Yeah. You must have been there for one of those. But it was exactly what we needed, right? Because the quality of golf that we were producing was not great.
What we needed in terms of doner kebab pizza or I don't know anyone needs a doner kebab pizza, to be perfectly honest. But it was what you need in terms of golf facilities and the type of setup.
Because we weren't, I think there was only a few of us that were members of golf clubs anywhere. Again, there's a lot of casual players. I think just to give some context, our friend Luke was, I think he played off 26 that first year.
And what's he play off today? Fast forward, how many years? Seven or eight years.
And he was, I think he's a single-digit handicap now. He's a good player, and he's probably better than that as well. So he's, but he'd never really played golf before. Again, this comes down to the football conversation. He irritated the hell out of me when we were playing football because he was probably one of the most talented football players I'd ever seen.
One of these guys naturally good at anything.
He could go and do any sport, and you're like, love him to
I don't even think we'll edit this, but
fine. I think I've told it to his face a number of times. We've been on, had a few drinks, but so many varying levels. But no one, I don't think anyone was better than maybe a 12, 11 handicap, something like that at that time.
Yeah,
and then subsequently, Alan decided to expand it and brought in some work colleagues, which I believe is where you came in.
That's right.
And we went to, I think we went to 18 numbers 1 year. I don't think we got to 24 that year. I think the 24, when we got to 24 or 12 aside, proper Ryder Cup format, that was when we went to Dorset somewhere. Well, Dorset, was it Devon? It might have been Devon somewhere, wasn't it?
Yeah. So
I flew into Exeter from Norwich that year.
Did you?
Yeah, flew in.
There's a flight that goes from Norwich to Exeter.
I don't think it exists anymore. But I flew from Dorset to Exeter and then I got...
You live the high life, don't
you? I know, I couldn't. But, well, it was much easier than driving it, right? Because you imagine trying to get from Norwich to...
Yeah, fair enough.
All the way around the M25 at the air. That wasn't for me. So that was the first time we had 24 of us. It was the Asprey Manor place.
Oh, yeah.
And it was wet.
Yeah.
And it was not enjoyable.
I missed that year.
And then discovered Dorset Country Club place, which is the one with the big lodges, which is where we...
Swedish-style lodges,
where we went for the kind of the last sort of 4 or 5 years, I think. Which was good fun, right? Because the golf had started to get a little bit better. Like the standard of golf was getting... better. We would still have a mix, right? So we'd still have, well, we had some handicap, the guys that were on a 3, 4, 5, 6 handicaps, so some good golfers there. And then we'd have the occasional guy who was playing off 28 but had never played golf before in their life. I can't remember the chap's name. It's one of Alan's friends who was brilliant.
Ricky, was it?
Ricky. And he, on the first tee, absolutely nailed a drive off the first tee about 250 yards down a fairway. And it was all of us cheering him on. It was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's a better quality course. It was still not so good that we felt out of place despite our varying abilities, but was tricky enough to be challenging for the good golfers as well.
Yeah. Well, you've made me reflect on a number of things that, because it's been going for a number of years now. And as you say, it's going to steadily grow and more, you know, so as you say, I was introduced into it through our mutual friend, Alan, and then in time, I've started introducing people into it. And to a man, every single person that I've introduced or I see is new to it or over the years, it's just like everyone loves it. They talk it. It's one of the first things that they look forward to in a new year on the calendar or whatever. And from my perspective, what I've come to really appreciate about it is we don't take ourselves too seriously in relation to the golf. It's all about just having fun and a laugh and catching up with the guys And actually, whilst golf is the kind of the main event, if you like, there's plenty that goes on around the outside of it as well in terms of watching any live football that's on the weekend together or we play cards or, you know, in the past, it's also been on Masters weekend.
Yeah.
You know, we've come in from the day's golf and watched the Masters on the TV and watched how real golfers actually play.
Yeah, it should be played.
Yeah, should be played. For me, alongside the enjoyment that I get out of golf in terms of playing it on my own, for example, I think the other type of golf that I really enjoy is that. It's like the camaraderie with a group of people. And as we'll get to talking about a bit more in this conversation, I think the relationship between many of us is, I think, new friendships have been formed and guys that have never met prior to that particular weekend. There's several instances now of them getting together, going out for drinks or food or whatever, and their partners getting to know each other and stuff. But yours and I's relationship has taken on a deeper meaning, I think, in the last year, especially. I think we should go to that now, if that's okay with you. So do you want to maybe start by, can you share your family story with us?
Yeah, sure. So I mentioned earlier that we moved to Norfolk 12 years ago. That was off the back of my first son being stillborn. My wife is originally from Norfolk, and I think I said to you yesterday, one of the things they talk about is you shouldn't make any life-changing decisions. And at the time, we were living down in Surbiton in Surrey, which is around where I'm from. I got offered the job to go and do the work that was based in Norwich the day that Dylan was born. Obviously, I didn't answer my phone. It went to voicemail, and I didn't pick it up until 2 days later. And my wife, Bryony, was in absolutely no condition to make any sort of decisions. As you can imagine, at that time, she was distraught and all over the place. And I was to a certain extent, but I kind of was in autopilot, because with her being kind of how she was emotionally and physically and all that kind of stuff, I went into I need to look after her type mode, which is probably a pretty natural thing to do for most men that find themselves in that situation, I would say. We benefit from baby loss in that way because we have got something to focus on. So we can make sure that, you know, our wives or partners are comfortable or are fed, washed, basic stuff like that, that, you know, Bryony wasn't getting out of bed for doing certain things, which is, I think, is totally understandable given the circumstances. But I just made the decision that we were going to move so I could get Bryony closer to her mum and dad, get Bryony closer to her friends and people that could help support, not just her, but me, to support her as well. I suppose it's probably a selfish way of...
And the move here was after losing Dylan.
Yeah, so well, I accepted that job. So we lost Dylan in the May in 2012. I accepted that job the same month, started it a few weeks later. Fortunately, my boss from my previous job is also one of my very close friends. And sadly, he had also been through something very similar. He had twin girls a few years before, one of which died shortly after she was born. So he was... So, I mean, he was, and he is to this day, one of the most supportive people I've ever had the privilege to call a friend. And when I said to him, look, and we had a great working relationship, we had lots of fun. We had each other's backs. There's a lot of loyalty there, which is why we're still friends to this day, I think. But when I said to him, I've got an opportunity to go, I feel like I need to get Bryony out of where we are, get her back. He was like, I totally understand. He's like, there's not going to be any hard feelings about this. It's important that you do what's right for you and your family, which was quite refreshing for, because I don't think I've had many people that I've worked for that have treated me in that way or seen me as just a number or whatever it might be that you work when you work in those kind of environments. So yeah, so we didn't move up straight away. I think we moved up in the June, and I started working originally in London for this company, but the role was on site at our company, and it's a recruitment role on site for Aviva. So I had to live with her mum and dad for the first month whilst we found a house, which was challenging, I would say. Not so much for me. I thought it was all right because I was getting out of the house every day to go to work. I was having lunches made for me to take to work with me as well. My mum would make me a lunch and all that kind of stuff. But I know Bryony struggled a bit with that because whether it was, I wouldn't say her mum was fussing over her, but she was obviously trying to make sure that Bryony was okay. But Bryony just didn't want any attention. She just wanted to wallow where she was. So I think she found that quite frustrating. But then we eventually found a house and moved. And then that's when I joined the first golf club I mentioned earlier, which was like 5 minutes up the road. So yeah, so my son Dylan would have been 12 this May. And then in 2022,
10th of May, right?
Yeah, 10th of May, yeah. Would which ironically is year. Also my old boss's birthday as well. So it was his, so it would have been his 40th birthday that year. And we've been planning to go away and all that kind of stuff, but obviously. And in 2022, we had the charity ball that we raised. Bryony's raised £50,000 for Tommy's since Dylan was born. And we had a...
Do you want to say a bit about Tommy's? What do they...
So they're a stillbirth and miscarriage charity. They do a lot of research into why stillbirth occurs, why miscarriages occur and things like that. And a lot of the money that we've done has gone towards basically helping other families not go through what we have been through with that, with that loss, because it's not just a stillbirth. She's had a miscarriage, and we've had to terminate for medical reasons for another baby who wasn't developing in the right way. So we've struggled with having children. And Tommy's have been brilliant because not only do they, obviously the money that they use from the fundraising is put to good use, but actually they're supporting of Bryony over that time and me to a certain extent. Like Bryony's the one who does all the fundraising. I'm kind of her support network, I suppose. Mm. So when she's training for a marathon or she's training to do a 2-mile open water swim or whatever, that obviously takes time and resource. So I would be the one that would go out and meet her halfway through her training runs to replenish her water and give her something to eat so she could keep going. Or I would obviously be a dad to my son who is here while she was doing that, keep him entertained and all that kind of stuff, because it is quite a commitment when you're going through those things. The actual run or the swim is a culmination of all of the hours of practice and preparation that she puts in, and that's where the real sort of sacrifice is for when you're doing those types of things. So I can never take any credit for any of the fundraising she's done, but I think she is probably, I might be speaking for her here, but she's probably thankful of the fact that she didn't have to worry about being a mum at that time. She could just go out and do the runs to practice and stuff to get her training regime in.
Yeah. Well, you know, firstly, thanks for sharing with us about Dylan. And if I may say, you know, I think from my perspective, and now having been through very similar loss, I've now come to really appreciate what it's like for what you and Bryony and your family have been through, first and foremost. Secondly, I'd say I've got a huge amount of admiration and respect for the work that you've both done. I mean, as you say, Bryony has very clearly done a power of work in so many things for charities like Tommy's. But then both of you, but especially you, because I had the privilege of meeting Bryony yesterday, and I really loved the chat that we had together in your house about you guys giving me that space to speak about Innes. And actually just knowing actually that I'm talking to people who you didn't judge anything that I said, or I didn't feel judged anything that I said. And I'm not necessarily saying that...
Which is quite surprising because she is quite judgy.
Do you want to leave that in or should we edit that out? I don't know.
She won't listen to this anyway. No,
cheers, Bryony. You know, you gave us the impression yesterday you were really, really keen for us to... But I say that in a way which is not to suggest that when I speak to people about my loss and grief that haven't been through something similar are judging me. But frankly, when you're talking with people who have been through something very similar or the same or whatever, you know, it's just that I felt much more comfortable being able to do that with you. As a man and as men, we know that typically we as a collective, men aren't brilliant at necessarily talking about feelings or mental health or whether it's grief in this case. What are the lessons that you have learned through this loss and this grief?
First of all, there's more to life than yourself. I think it's fair to say, and Bryony and I have talked about this a lot over the years, I don't think we really liked each other that much when we got married. I think we loved each other, but I think we were going through the motions a little bit. And to be honest with you, I was a bit of a selfish prick even before we got married. You know, I didn't really take much consideration for how she was feeling about life in general, really. I'd say, you know, she'd moved down from Norfolk to Surrey to be with me, and I would go out with work until 2 a.m. in the weekdays and stuff like that. She's not really, well, she, you know, she hadn't really got tons of friends down here that she can just go around their houses and things like that. So, well, actually, when the stuff happened with Dylan, it made me kind of reevaluate my priorities, and to see how strong she was made me realize how much I should admire her and how much of a hero she was to me for going through what she went through with such grace. And how do I describe it? She just carried herself in such a graceful manner through all of that shit. Yes, she had times where she was in a dark place, right? Yes, she had times where she didn't want to be near me or near anyone, or, you know, I don't blame her for that, to be honest. You know, that's a natural reaction to the stuff we were going through. It just made me kind of reevaluate that actually there is more to life than just what I want to do, and that I need to refocus my attention on making sure my wife has everything she needs and everything she wants. And I actually want her to be able to enjoy spending time with me, and I want to enjoy spending time with her. And I think, in fairness, on the flip side of that, it's fair to say that she was quite a serious character before Dylan was born. she felt like she needed to control quite a lot of things, which may have been why I didn't want to come home at times, because I was worried that I was going to be told off, basically, which is a bizarre thing to think about, isn't it? It's my mum would tell me off, not my wife, but I mean, the wild wives do tell us off, but that's a different thing. But I think when she lost Dylan, it made her realise that she cannot control everything. So she had to relinquish that control a little bit. And actually, weirdly, she laughed more afterwards. Well, not immediately afterwards. Obviously, there was a period of time where she didn't laugh at anything. Nothing was amusing, but she started to take herself a little less seriously. I started to pay a little bit more attention to her. And I think that helped draw us closer together. And I think it's fair to say that we would definitely consider each other to be best mates now. Like, we have such a lot. And, you know, it's given that we also both work from home in the same room, and we have done for the last 4 years, and we still get on like an absolute house on fire, you know. And we have times where we get a bit tetchy with one another and all that kind of stuff, as most married couples do. But if we do, it's gone, and we've kind of moved on from that. So the main thing for me with all of what we've been through is you start to understand what is important to you. And me going out with my mates, whilst it might be fun, it's not really that important. Not that I'm saying I don't enjoy going out with my friends, I do, but I don't need to be doing it every week. I need to be spending more time being a bit more considerate and spending time with my family, because they're the ones that are going to be with me throughout everything that goes on. So I think that's probably the key learn for me with that.
Yeah, it's fair to say that baby loss and the grief that you experience with it, certainly my experience has been a very complex one. And it's good, I think, that you're being so open in relation to the challenges and difficulties that surface in a relationship after you've been through something like that. What's been your own experience of talking about Dylan, talking about your son, you know, speaking with people who may not have been through the same and may sometimes not know what to say, or
it's been an interesting road through that, I would say, because I'm not one for shying away from stuff. Like, I find it really difficult when people say to me when I talk to them about Jensen and they say, oh, you know, have you got any other kids? I sometimes struggle, because what I want to say to them is, yes, actually I do. One is in heaven, whether you believe in heaven or not. One we believe is in heaven. And we've had two others that were very young, or, you know, were very small when they went in the miscarriages. But sometimes it's not really always appropriate to go down that route. But I do always, like, even to the point where I had a conversation on Friday with my boss's boss's boss. It's the first day we've just moved into his area, so he's doing like the rounds with, and having regular catch-ups with everyone. And he asked me about my background, and I told him that when I worked at Aviva and all that kind of stuff. And I said, he said, what took you from where you were in Surrey to Norwich? So I said, well, at the time, my son was stillborn. And I could see that he was kind of shocked with what I was saying. But actually, he was quite receptive to it. I remember why he's probably good at his job, is because he's able to deal with those things. But it's interesting to see people's reactions when I tell them. I'm not going to not tell them, because it's an important part of my life. And it's not like I'm saying that I always talk about it, because I don't. But if people ask me about my story, about why I am where I am, why I live where I live, and all that kind of stuff, that is the main part of why we moved to Norfolk. Is so that I could get Bryony closer to her mum and dad. And, you know, we could start to... I mean, we'd been looking to... Because what we wanted to do was start a family here, because we could afford to buy a house around here and all that kind of stuff as well, granted. But if there's that sliding doors moment, isn't there? And that is a big part of why we moved to Norfolk, was because of Dylan. And I can only thank him for that, as I love it here. As you know, I talk about this place all the time. It is a challenge, because it's about... I don't like making people feel uncomfortable. But then equally, if they're going to ask questions about me, I'm going to tell them the truth.
Right.
So, but I think you have periods of time where, and again, I think we sort of brushed over this yesterday, and I think you said it to me, is that you expect, there are certain people in your life you expect to kind of stand up and be counted when these sorts of things happen. But the truth is, don't always work that way.
No.
Actually, what you tend to find is the people that are probably on the periphery, they're the ones that are more likely to step into that space and offer you the support you may need. The saddest thing about it is, because usually they've experienced something similar.
Yeah. In creating this platform, this podcast, it's partly about raising awareness of important issues. And I'm sure you'd agree with me, Ben, in saying that, I mean, baby loss as a subject is kind of taboo, right? You know, people don't talk about it, or certainly this has been my experience. In the experience of losing a baby, you learn a bunch of stuff about it that you never wish to learn, but you're forced to learn because it happens to you. But I guess, you know, one thing I'd say is, and to this point you've just raised about certain people that in their friends and family network who you might reasonably expect to show up in a certain way and behave in a certain way might not, and that's quite upsetting. But I guess I would say, and I'm going to welcome your input to this in a moment, is one of the, you know, for anyone that's listening to this, and if you encounter someone that's just experienced grief or loss or the loss of a loved one, but especially in the context of a baby, I mean, there is no right thing that you can say to anyone, first and foremost. And there is no thing that you can say that will take away the pain or the loss of that person's experienced. But probably one of the best things I think you can say is just, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry for your loss.
Even saying, I really don't know what to say.
Yeah.
Because then it gives the person that's actually on the receiving end of all the shit that's happening,
yeah,
it gives them an opportunity to steer the conversation, because they may not want to talk about it at all. They may want to talk about something completely different.
Yeah.
Let's talk about this. Or they may say, this is how I'm feeling.
Yeah. And I'm grateful you've brought up this subject of speaking your truth, essentially, because...
By the way, I absolutely detest that saying. I just want to put that out there. Detest it. There is no such thing as your truth. It's the truth. You have an opinion, right? You're saying your opinion. Your truth does not exist. But it is about being genuine with yourself, right? And actually talking about how you feel. And no one can say whether you're right or wrong for feeling that way, because that's down to you, how you feel about things. So let's go with that, all right? No more your truth.
So, okay, speaking the truth. Okay, yeah. I stand corrected. Because in promoting this podcast, which I have to be honest, it kind of feels kind of uncomfortable to me at this stage, like that idea of self-promotion. But I think there's a part of it that feels uncomfortable, because I don't know if you somehow experienced this in your loss of Dylan, say, but me introducing this podcast to people and talking about it and the concept is, I almost feel an urge to say, oh, well, I lost my son last year, kind of thing. And it's like, that's a very important part. I mean, Innes is my inspiration for doing this. But it's, how's your experience been of almost getting comfortable with yourself in talking about dealing with, because you can't control how other people are going to react,
no,
to how they're going to feel.
And I think that's one of the advantages that we have as men, is that we care less about what people think of us, generally, I would say, certainly than women in our lives.
I mean, I would challenge that on the basis that I care deeply too much, I think, about what other people
potentially
think.
But then maybe that's because I've been hardened to it, because it happened to me 12 years ago. Maybe in 10 years' time, you may be less worried about what people are going to think about you saying this stuff. But there are times where, if you have an opinion on something, because I know you're quite an opinionated chap, you're not going to hold back on having that conversation with
respectfully
someone.
Opinionated.
Respectfully opinionated. Okay, yeah, but either way, but you know what I mean. Like, so with this particular subject, yes, I understand the insecurity of you wanting to not go out and worry about what people might say. I get that. I get that. Yeah. But there are plenty of other things in your life that you have a view on that you will happily say, and you don't care whether someone disagrees with you or not. And that's, maybe there's some, it might not be a male thing, maybe it's just in my experience, but certainly Bryony cares more about what people think than I do. Always has done. I'm just who I am. And if people don't like me, that's fine. I'm not going to be everyone's cup of tea. That's not a problem.
Yeah.
But I actually also find that the more I can try and be genuine, the easier it is for people to understand whether they want to engage with me or not. And then less time I waste with people who don't want to engage with me.
Yeah.
And I think when you start to talk about baby loss, yes, it's difficult for people, but it's, I've got two friends here in Norwich, my two best mates here in Norwich. I can talk to them about any of that stuff. That is key to me, because they don't shy away from it. They're receptive of it. They understand that they understand that they don't get it. And that's all right. I don't need them to get it.
No.
I just need to be able to talk about it occasionally. Not all the time, as I said. It's not something that we talk about regularly. But there are things that we talk about where we've talked about the decision for Bryony and I not to try for any more children because of the losses we've been through and all that kind of stuff. You know, that was harder for me, perhaps, than it was for Bri, because Bri had been through the physical and emotional stuff, whereas I'd only really been through the emotional side of it. Didn't make any difference to me physically what she was going through. Emotionally, it was difficult for me, but realizing that Jensen's going to be an only child, it wasn't the easiest thing for me to digest. However, I think it's the right thing. But I needed to be able to mull that over in my head to get to the conclusion that, yes, this is the right thing. I can't put my wife through any of this stuff again. I'm not prepared to do it. And actually, I'd much rather Jensen had two happy parents that got on well so that he has a healthy upbringing. I mean, he might turn out to be a complete nightmare, but we will have given him the best opportunities to not be a serial killer, I suppose, which is the key.
Well, he's into... Let's talk about Jensen. Jensen's what, seven?
Eight.
Eight,
yeah. He's eight. He'll be nine later this year.
And he's a member of this golf club?
No, he's not a member yet. No, he's not. He's going to be joining the academy in the summer if they've got space for him. So I started bringing him down here in around September time, got him his own golf clubs over the summer, just to see how he got on with it, really, because he's not the sportiest kid in the world. He quite likes his cricket. Obviously, he plays cricket in the summer, but he's not really into his football, not really into rugby or all that kind of stuff. He's actually quite musical. He's learning the drums at school, likes his drama stuff. So he was in, had a singing part, a singing solo part in the Nativity and things like that. So, you know, he's got quite a lot of confidence when it comes to being on stage, but he's just not a particularly sporty kid, which is a bit weird for both of us because we were both quite sporty when we were children. She did a lot of athletics and played a bit of hockey. And then I was, obviously, as I mentioned earlier, played a lot of football and cricket and stuff. So not that I'm disappointed. I'm not disappointed that he doesn't play a lot of football because I don't really like the game anymore. If I watch it on TV, I think it's the golden era of football for me was the 90s and the early 2000s. I think that was when it had peaked. And actually, if I watch it now, I just get fed up with it.
Why?
VAR and all that kind of nonsense.
Okay, less said about that, Ben.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to get into the whole commercial, too much money in it, and then...
Yeah, I mean, that's also a big part of it, right? I think the money that's gone into that sport has effectively ruined it, if you think about... You know, I mean, it'd be really interesting to see what happens with Manchester City with the financial fair play stuff. I hope they get chucked out of the league, because you can't... 115 charges is just an insane...
We do love and welcome any Man City fans to this podcast.
I'm a guest, so you have to say that.
I don't have to see it. I choose to see it.
Fine, okay. Yeah, fine. Okay. So I don't dislike Manchester City fans.
Much in the way you choose to say speaking the truth rather than your truth. Yeah. Potato.
Yeah, fair enough. But I don't have any problems with Manchester City fans. I have a problem with the way the club is run. You can't have a billionaire owner come in and then suddenly they become one of the top earning clubs in the world, despite the fact they can't sell their stadium out. Doesn't make sense, does it? You know, it doesn't make sense. Anyway, let's not go down that route.
No, that's fine.
I'm not bitter about it at all. But anyway, I would like him to play golf because I want to be able to be in a position where when we get older, we can play golf together. I think that would be a lovely thing to be able to do with him. I think that he would benefit quite a lot from the academy because there's a lot of kids in this academy, so he could potentially make some good mates to go out and play with. I like the idea, as I said earlier, I like the idea of him coming down here on a Saturday afternoon, him going off to do whatever, and we can, when he's a bit older, we can just leave him here to enjoy some time with his friends and then pick him up a bit later on. I think that's...
And he's starting to... His introduction to the game is he's quite young. You started playing when you were how old?
Probably about his age as well.
Oh, was it? Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I think so.
But he's starting early and he's got every opportunity to be a better golfer than you, which is, you know, the bar's not very high, is it?
You'll get there quite quickly, I think.
Yeah, good.
That also means he'd be better than you, though.
Yeah, well, that's not hard either, to be perfectly honest. I really hope he is.
Yeah,
and he'll be on this podcast in years to come. He'll be giving me in tips and he'll sort my swing out. Golf Yourself Healthy is built on the idea that golf is good for you. And certainly for me, it's one of the first things I wanted to do when we lost Innes. Would it be a stretch to say for you that, well, how do you feel about golf being good for you? And how, if at all, has it been... How's your relationship with golf changed in any way since you've been through
golf? I think it has. I think if I trying to put this in a kind of like a chronological order, right? I would say that when we lost Dylan, I spent probably a year looking after Bryony, I would say, like making sure she was up and about. She wasn't working and all that kind of stuff. And then we had the miscarriage sort of 6 months later, which was probably a mistake for us to try again, but she was in such a weird space, I would say, that I think she kind of said, if we don't have one now, I don't think I'm ever going to want another one after that, which is probably the wrong thing for us to do, but that's what we did. But I think, as she mentioned to you yesterday, I think she was saying that when she had that miscarriage removed, it was the first time she'd ever been under general anaesthetic. And I remember her saying to me the next day, the last thing I remember thinking about when they were putting me under is, I hope I wake up. And she said, and that was a defining moment for her to realize that actually she did want to carry on. She'd been so down and was such a recluse, didn't want to do anything, and I don't think that I wasn't worried about her doing anything silly to herself, but I kind of would have understood, right? Like if she'd made any sort of attempt like that. So for her to be able to go under general anaesthetic for the first time and literally say, I hope I wake up, was such a defining moment for her. And it gave her kind of a bit of an impetus to kind of change the narrative that she was kind of living, I would say. That's when we got the dog. I sort of said, look, it's a bit of a cliche, but maybe we should get a dog. We'd always talked about having a dog. She had a dog when she was a kid, and I'd always wanted to have a dog. So we went and got Barney that Christmas. So that was Christmas Eve. She had the miscarriage removed. Then I had my 30th birthday on the Boxing Day. And then New Year's Day, we picked up Barney from Skegness. We like to think we rescued him from Skegness.
We also welcome listeners from Skegness.
I'm just throwing shade at everyone at this point in time.
Yeah. And I choose to welcome them. I don't have to.
Yeah, no, that's fine. And she always talks about him being her rescuer, basically, because he gave her a reason to get up every morning. And he also made me get up at like 3 a.m. to let him out for a wee when he was a puppy and that kind of stuff. I remember it snowed quite heavily that winter as well. And I remember standing in the garden 4 in the morning in dressing gown and slippers in a foot of snow, trying to get Barney as a puppy to have a poo before he would come back into the house.
That sounds like me and my dog. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's very familiar. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it is a cliche, but dogs are amazing. I think that they give so much more than they take. And yeah, he gave her a reason to get up. And then after 3 months of training him, I think she started to go a bit stir crazy and she's like, right, I need to go back to work.
Right.
So we looked for a job. And she got a job working for Savills, the estate agents, as an admin PA type person. And it was only when she started to sort of get back to her, not back to herself, because I was thinking, you're never going to be the same, are you? But when when I started needing to look after her less, that's when I realised I had never really dealt with what we'd been through. And so I remember during that year, I had a end of year review with my boss. And at the time, I was quite pleased with what she said, and the reason she said it, she wasn't saying anything to be malicious or anything like that. That wasn't her intention. She basically said to me, you wouldn't know that you've been through what you've been through in the year that you've worked with us. Your work is great, everyone gets on with you, and no one would know unless you tell them that you'd lost your children. So what she was trying to say is that I was showing a level of professionalism in my work that meant that I could just kind of carry on. But it's only in hindsight I think that's probably not a good thing, because all I did was bury it. I literally didn't let it impact me at all, didn't deal with it. I always sort of used golf as the escape from dealing with stuff, right? If I was at home and I was having to look after Bryony, every Saturday evening in the summer, I'd go out and play golf that year. So I'd go out and I'd think, yeah, you know, I'm getting away from things, getting away from this. And then actually what I would end up doing is thinking about it. And that was how I kind of, along with having some therapy after Bryony went back to work, I did get some professional help just to kind of deal with those feelings of emotion, those feelings of trying to get to grips with what had happened, I suppose. But it's actually on the golf courses where I did the majority of my thinking, right? So all of those times I was in therapy and my therapist would say, when you're thinking about these sorts of things, try and process it in this way or whatever it might have been, whatever things. That was what I was doing when I was out on the golf course, because I was alone with my thoughts. I couldn't escape what had happened to me. I couldn't just think about something different. Your brain don't work that way, does it? And so over that following year, I think that's when I started to perhaps deal with it a little bit better, perhaps understand what had happened to me a little, or not to me, but what had happened to us a little better. And to just that in itself was therapy for me, right? I couldn't hide from myself. I had to answer my own questions about why I felt the way I did. Why was I? I remember I wrote an article for someone's blog post who was, she runs something called the Rainbow Running Club. And I remember finishing. As I was writing that, I was like, I can't really understand to this day why I felt so numb when Dylan was born. Like, I just didn't feel anything. I didn't feel sad. Obviously, I wasn't happy, but I didn't feel sad. And I just couldn't connect with what Bryony had been through on a physical level. And I struggled with it on an emotional level. And maybe it was down to the fact that I obviously, you know, as a man, I didn't carry Dylan. But I just, maybe that was just my way of naturally trying to cope with what was happening, which isn't a healthy thing. It's not a healthy thing, but it's probably more natural for some people than it is for others. And for me, that was how I dealt with it. I just sort of shut myself, compartmentalized it, just shut it off. Don't think about it, don't deal with it. And then just concentrate on Bri. That's all you got to do. Just make sure she's all right, which is fine for a period of time, but then that compartmentalization starts to edge its way back over to the thing. And then, yeah, that's where the wall broke down when I was in playing golf. I was just strolling around aimlessly, really, not even really thinking about what I was doing with a golf ball or anything like that, thinking about, okay, what does this actually mean to me?
Yeah, no, it's It does sound like, like you say, golf created that space for you just to think. And actually, reflecting on it now, probably that, aside the fact I wanted to get out in the golf course because I knew it would give me that soon after losing Innes, I think it just, I had a really grand point to make there and it's completely gone out of my head, but it'll come back to me. Something I do remember really quite clearly and vividly was the chronology of it now in the timeline of events, I don't quite remember, but I seem to remember, maybe you'll remember, but around the time, I think my wife Kim and I had been given the really traumatic news about Innes's prognosis. And basically, I was in the car park at my golf club actually on the phone to you because I was just about to go out on the course and play a few holes. And you said a number of things to me then, which, you know, the whole conversation really prepared me for what was going to be a really quite horrendous situation, was to go into hospital, watch, and whilst my son is being, you know, my son is going to be born sleeping. Mm-hmm. He's going to be born dead. And a few things you said. You said, one, you know, the silence will be deafening. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful to you for saying that because it was. Mm-hmm. The silence was piercing, you know, and it was... But also you said to me that, and drawing on obviously the experience you've had in supporting Bryony over, you know, since that time, was you're going to have to put your mental health on the back burner or something like that. It was it words to that effect. And I have to admit, of all the things that you said to me, that really shocked me, or that was very jarring. And I say this because I think for quite a long time now, I've been someone who, anyone that knows me well knows that I talk openly about my depression, my anxiety, and my mental health and things, and then mental health generally. And so to hear someone say to me, yours isn't going to be as priority as someone else's, was somehow like, oh shit, I don't really want to have to deal with that in a way. But actually, you're right, what you say about what our wives, partners go through when they, because the woman carries, the woman, there are things that they experience which we don't physically, right?
And hormonally as well, right? If you think about it, it's, you know, their body is expecting them to have a baby to look after, that kind of thing as well. So,
and I think you've touched on it already, is I think the message here is once you experience this sort of loss, baby loss, you know, it's support as a man. There is definitely a role for you there in just being as supportive as you can to your wife through the absolute spectrum of emotions that she will go through. You'll both go through. There are some very ugly feelings that come up, aren't there, in that situation. But
I think it's important as well. What I didn't want you to think, as I was saying, you put your mental health on pause forever, right? It's just about that period of time, so that when, and you know when it happens, right, when they start to, when the ladies in our life start to get back towards being functional again, right, that's basically what it is, it's about them being part of society again and all that kind of stuff, that's when you can then start to think, all right, well, maybe I need to sort my own shit out, really. I need to start having that self-reflection on that kind of stuff. And I think that's something that it took me a while to realize, that actually I did need to think about how it was impacting me, because I think where I'd put my own mental health on kind of pause, I'd say, I don't think I ever really wanted to unpause it. I would have quite happily carried on and not dealt with it. But the reality is that would not have been a healthy way of doing things. And the questions start to come into your brain when you are in those periods of reflection, which you do a lot of in golf, right? You spend a lot of time, especially if you're playing in the evenings on your own and all that kind of stuff, you spend a lot of time just you on your own, just with your own thoughts. And that's where they start niggling at you. And that's when you start thinking, actually, I've got some serious issues here, and I need to deal with these things.
Well, I love the way you've described that, what golf's given you in that respect. I think this is what I was trying to, the point I was going to make before, and it still hasn't come back to me, by the way, and I don't think it will between now and the end of the conversation. But
you can add it in.
Yeah, I can. Yeah,
let's just do a pause.
We'll add it in.
Let's pause
post
it for 1 second.
Yeah.
No, you can add it in.
It's, you're saying it's created that space for you to think without boundaries, and I think it's come back. I think that's the point
Excited
I was going to make.
If this isn't very good,
I think it's quite it's distinctly mediocre.
Okay, fine.
But no, it's that actually golf for me in the sort of the immediate aftermath after losing Innes had to be on my own. It couldn't really be with other people, I don't think, because what I was experiencing was, as we've talked about already, anyone that I would go out and play golf with
didn't know how to talk to you.
Correct.
Or
yeah.
engage with
and
you.
And I was very much in a place of like, you speak to me and my life revolves around the loss of my son at the moment. So whether you like it or not, I'm going to be telling you about him. You're going to act awkward about it. I'm going to feel crappy because I don't feel let down and resentful.
And especially if you play with people regularly as well, right, who know you and will have known what was going on.
Yeah.
I mean, the advantage I had when we moved to North, no one knew who I was, so I could go around without having to say hello to people or any of that sort of stuff anyway, right? So
and I also made the mistake, you talk about making mistakes, by the way, and sort of wrong decisions in relation to trying to conceive again, and I just, for what it's worth, I think you're being hard on yourselves with
maybe
that so much as your brain just scrambled basically. I don't know if there are right or wrong decisions that you can make in what is such a disorientating time, but it leads me to talking about, I didn't help myself at the time in my relationship with golf, where I'd got myself onto the board at my golf club and all of a sudden just became this person to the members at my golf club where, like,
you actually
approached
helped to
me.
Interact with people.
I forced myself into an interact. I think it was. But I think there's an important message that lies in here as well, which we're both touching on, which is kind of, we pursue certain interests or goals or aspirations, and we go after things after a loss because it's a way of healing. But actually, you kind of, you just have to go with it, because some of the decisions that you make will end up being really inspired. But others, like I think the instance I talk about of going on the board at my golf club within about 2 weeks of losing my son was a...
probably not the right thing to do.
No, it was,
however,
it was a bit of a misplaced kind of like...
And as long as you can learn something from it, right?
Yeah.
And that's a bit of a cliche, but I think even when we talked about what I learned from the Dylan situation, and I've mentioned obviously about what Bryony learned from that and then obviously the subsequent miscarriage as well after that. We have both, our relationship has improved exponentially since then.
Yeah.
And I often get asked, well, I don't know, maybe often, but I have been asked in the past, would I change what happened to us? And in a weird way, I don't think I would.
Mm.
Like, because we wouldn't, if Dylan had been here, let's say he got to, so to give some context, Bryony had some issues with her, how thick her blood was is probably the simplest way to put it. So her blood would clot quite easily, which meant that the placenta was getting blood clots in it, which meant that the blood wasn't flowing into Dylan and he wasn't getting the right levels of nutrients, which meant that he wasn't growing at the right rate. So his brain was fine. He was perfectly, because his brain prioritized the oxygen flow into it to make sure that grew, but his limbs were short, right? So what they said to us is, if we can get him to a viable weight, 500 grams, they said, which is just over a pound for old Bunny, then we'll have an emergency cesarean, because we can do more for him out of the body. He'll obviously be in intensive or NICU for a long time whilst we try and give him the right nutrients so the rest of his body can kind of catch up. It may be that he always has physical issues and all that kind of stuff. And he was she went for she was being scanned every week effectively, and she went for a scan and they'd said his heart stopped. And when he was actually born, he weighed 410, 415, something like that, grams. So he wasn't a long way off, but he was sufficiently small when his heart stopped. It wouldn't have made any difference if they got him out at that point. He wouldn't have been viable to survive. I've completely lost my train of thought with this.
No, but there was something Bryony said it last night. It ties to what you've just said. Is she said, I think what we've gained is more than what we've lost.
Yeah. Yeah, this is where I was going with it, right? If we'd managed to if we'd managed to get him to a viable weight and he'd been born, I think the stress on our relationship of that situation probably would have driven us apart. As I mentioned earlier, we didn't really like each other much at that time anyway. And I don't think we would be together anymore. I think she would have realised I was a complete tool and divorced me probably pretty quickly. He's given me...
You said last night that she'd come to her senses at some point and realise how amazing you were.
Yeah, no chance.
So don't try and butter it up for the listeners, you know? So go on.
So he has given us more because he's made us realise that the most important person in the world to me, other than Jensen now, obviously, is Bryony. And I'd like to think she thinks the same of me. And I'd like to think that she feels that she's got someone in me that can support her through anything that's thrown at us. And likewise, I know that I can rely on her to be my rock and my inspiration, any of that sort of stuff as well. So I don't think I would change it, because I don't think I'd be the person I am today, which isn't, I'm not a great person, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that I'm a wonderful human being. I'm not, I have the same issues that a lot of others do, but I do like to think that I'm a little bit more considerate than I used to be. I like to think that when my friends are going through crap as well, that I'll always be on hand to do whatever they need me to do and all that kind of stuff. And I don't know if I would have ever changed the way I was if it hadn't been for him. And that would have been a bit of a waste, really, I think. So yeah, so I wouldn't change that.
I wanted to make sure in this podcast we at least touched on your experience at the Masters, because it's just one of those experiences. It's a bucket list experience in golf.
100%.
For the committed golfer.
100%.
And there's not even. You're the only person I think I know who's been.
Really?
Yeah. So tell us, what's it like? I mean, did it live up to your expectations?
Yes, is the short answer. I mean, I think there's a couple of things that I potentially would have changed, because on competition days, you can't take your phones in. You have to leave your phones outside the grounds. You can't get any photos or anything like that. But if you go on practice days, you can take photos of the course. So that's one of the things. I think it would have been quite cool to go to a practice day so we could get some pictures when we're there. But I mean,
just based on the fairly limited experience I've going to watch live golf, that's a normal.
No, that's a Masters. That's an Augusta.
Classic Augusta
thing. Because they also insist that they are the ones that do all of the footage.
Yeah.
Coverage is all done by Augusta. It's not done by the PGA Tour. It's all done by Augusta, because then they control the rights for it.
Mm.
And I think they're worried about people videoing golf shots and things like that, because it dilutes their power in that space. But that whole trip was...
But I think that there's almost something I quite like about that, in so much as it controls the mystique that
for
is
sure,
around.
For sure. I like to experience stuff, right? So to give you an example... When we got married, Brian was like, are we getting a videographer? And I was like, no, I want a photographer, but I don't want someone to video our wedding. And she was like, well, why not? And I said, because I want to remember it for how I remember it. I don't want to remember it when I watch the video back, when you make me watch the video back of our wedding.
Yeah,
and think, actually, that's not how I remember that happening, which will always happen, right? There'll always be things in there that you think, oh, I missed that. I don't care about the things I missed. I only really care about the things I experienced. So actually not being able to take photos... As long as my memory stays intact, that's always going to be in my head. Like I can picture now exactly where we sat on that Sunday watching. We sat next to the 15th green, which is the par 5 with the water in front.
Is that the one where Sergio had a mare?
Yeah.
Sergio Garcia.
Yeah, yeah.
Justin
Rose, he was playing against Justin Rose. Oh, didn't he win that year? Was it that year? I can't remember. It might have been the year after he won.
The year that Sergio won?
Yeah.
No, that was a year we were at Crettingham for the Ryder Cup thing we were doing, yeah.
Anyway, yeah, so that hole, so it's a par 5.
Was that the year that he was defending it?
Might have been, yeah.
The year after that, yeah.
Because the year he won it was against Justin Rose, wasn't it?
Yes, it was,
So yeah, it's a par 5 that plays up onto the top of a hill, and then it's two shots into the green, and we sat there for the majority of the day. We walked around a little bit earlier in the day, but that was such a good place to... plot up, if you like, because we could nip out and get beers. Food there was really good as well, so you could get food, which was dirt cheap as well. I think they said that you could order everything on the menu once at Augusta, and it wouldn't cost you more than $69 for the entire menu. And it was a big menu, right? There was a lot of stuff on there. So the prices there were like $1.50 for a sandwich.
What was the pick of the items on the menu?
Well, they bang on about this pimento cheese.
I was going to ask you about that
sandwich, but
it was very mixed reviews.
It was average, I would say. The barbecue pork thing they did was really good, and then they had this kind of pecan popcorn stuff, which was also really decent. But yeah, so we found the right spot, and then we spent. There was, how many of us were there? Six of us sat in there. 8 of us went. 2 of the boys went to watch Arsenal play at lunchtime because they're pair of losers. And then they came back in and they couldn't find us. We didn't have any phones, so they didn't know where we were sat, right?
Feels like the sort of thing that only an Arsenal fan would do.
Yeah, and they lost as well.
They
lost.
Did they?
So, yeah.
So funny. Can we just add, who do you support?
I'm a Spurs fan.
Right.
But so there were 6 of us there, and then what we were doing is we were betting between us, I think it was like $5 a 2 ball that would come through, and you would choose which one of them would make birdie or better on this thing. If neither of them made birdie, then the money went carried over to the next one. And so we would take it in turns,
between us.
And we had an awesome afternoon just watching them come in. And then when it was finishing and there was Rahm and Koepka going up the 18th, we managed to get to the side so we could see their approach shots. And Rahm put his tee shot into the trees on 18. And then I think he hit provisional but found his first one. I had quite a bit of money on Brooks Koepka as well, which is a bit annoying because he let me down, but... It was just
how many days of the 4-day?
We just went on the Sunday. So
final day.
We got there the Thursday. And then on the Friday, we went to, I mean, we went just went with Your Golf Travel. They organised it for us. And then we went to, they had like a hospitality thing in Augusta. So we went there, which was like food and drink, all complimentary, a golf driving, a golf simulator thing in there and all of the screens up. And then they had in the evening, I think Danny Willett came in and did a bit of Q&A and all that kind of stuff. So that was quite cool. So we got pretty drunk that day. And then the Saturday, we were meant to play golf in Columbia, which is where we were staying. But the weather was horrendous on the Saturday. I don't know if you remember the two trees came down at Augusta.
Hmm.
That was on the Saturday and the weather was just biblical rain. And then, so we just, I think we went to a bar and then maybe went out for the evening or something. I can't really remember. And then on the Sunday, we went to Augusta. You wouldn't have been able to tell it had rained. There was a couple of boggy-ish bits, but the course was just immaculate. And then, yeah, had maybe 8 hours of watching some of the best golfers knock the ball around, not Rory McIlroy because he missed the cut, as we talked about yesterday, which is another reason I'm not a massive fan of his.
It had something to do with a bet?
Oh, no, not that, not no. That time, just over the years.
Oh, I see.
Cost me a lot. Where
yeah, it's betting bit, yeah, okay. Yeah. So it's not against the human
well,
being.
No, like, and he, yeah. he did annoy me, so I went
there
to...
Are
I was word, lucky
there
enough.
Are names for people like you, Ben. Like, I know, you know, yeah, and I know. It's this is a growing trend in golf. Like,
but
you know,
it bothered you. What people, really tipped it off
people
for
like
me.
You sledging professional golfers just for trying to do their job. Just
yeah, but okay,
you lost
okay,
bet.
I know, okay. So doing their job, fine, I get that, right? 2015, Open, St Andrews. Lucky enough to go along to watch that, right? Was excited about seeing Rory McIlroy play because he was one of the, I think he was number one in the world at the time.
Were you, or were you excited about the return that you might have got on your bet?
No, I didn't back him. Louis Oosthuizen that year.
Oh, okay.
Who came second, I think, or third. He was on the playoff with Zach Johnson, who won it. Him and Mark Leishman. Anyway, and the day before the Masters, I'm pretty sure it was the day before, it might have been a couple of days before, Rory McIlroy was playing five-a-side football with his mates and went over on his ankle and then was injured for the Open, so I didn't get to see him. So I was most annoyed at that. But I did get to see Tiger Woods, which was pretty cool.
Very cool.
So yeah, the Masters trip was just otherworldly, I would say.
So what's your defining memory, if you had to pick out one from your trip to the Masters?
The one thing I remember very vividly was when we were walking up that 18th, and it was 10 people deep at that point. And obviously I had a bit of money on Brooks Koepka, who was like 3 or 4 shots behind at that time, and I just remember seeing John Rahm's tee shot just veer left into the trees, and I thought, I've got a chance here. I've got a chance. He might come back into it. And then the disappointment I felt when he walked up and found his first ball and played his first ball. I can't even remember if it was his first ball that he played. He may have. I mean, he won comfortably anyway, didn't he? But the roar out of there when he held that putt was, you couldn't even see the green, but the roar on it was just phenomenal. And it was such a cool trip. And the boys we went with were such good fun with those guys. And then we went and played golf in Kira Island for 3 days after as well, which was
spectacular. I saw you using that nice ball marker thing,
the Osprey
it,
Point from Kira
Island, yeah.
We played the ocean course there, which is the one, I think it's hardest rated in America, and it was tough.
That course?
Yeah, the ocean course.
Ocean course of Kira Island, yeah.
But it was meant to, it was really quite a spectacular views and all that kind of stuff, so.
So another question I have for you, maybe we'll probably make this the last one. If you could relive one golfing memory which involves you playing,
okay,
what would it be? And talk us through the shot. Talk us through the shots, okay. The hole.
I mean, this is
Talk me through the round. I mean, that's getting excessive now. But like,
this is the one, right? This is the one that I always annoy people with if they ever bother listening to me. But I've been lucky enough to play in the old course at St Andrews a couple of times, and I was playing pretty well, probably one of the best rounds I've had at the old course. And on 18, I hit a drive.
This is the road hole?
No, the road hole's the 17th.
Yeah, okay. The one that you knock it over the top of
the hotel, yeah. So I bogeyed that, which I was quite happy with.
Sorry, I shot.
No, it's fine. So yeah. I hit my drive on 18. And I was very conscious that the right, there's all those houses, all the buildings and the shops and all that kind of stuff. I ended up pulling it quite a long way to the left. When I walked up to the ball, like all the three other boys that I was playing with, they were kind of middle of the fairway on the right-hand side, but I was a long way left. And the first and the 18th play alongside one another. And there's a little road that goes across the middle of, like a track-type road that goes right across the middle of the first and the 18th. And as I walked up to it, the caddy said to me, and my ball was on this road, my caddy said to me, just move it off the road. And I said, yeah, but this particular road, I'm not allowed to move this ball off, am I? I should play it from here because that's a local rule. It's not one that you can just pick and move it off the thing. And then she was brilliant. I think she played on the ladies' tour at some point. But she said, they're not going to know, just move it. I said, if I do that and they see that, they're going to crucify me. So I said, I'm just going to have to play it from here. And she's like, all right. She said, what are you going to do? And then, yeah, I still had about maybe 100 yards into the green with the Valley of Sin in front of me. So I said, I'm going to chip a hybrid. So can you pass me my hybrid, please? She passed me the hybrid out. And I chipped it like a little punchy chip all the way through, rolled up through the Valley of Sin, stopped 10 feet from the pin.
What sort of distance are you hitting this?
About 100 yards. So it's like a proper little sort of punchy chip approach. And it rolled up, went through the Valley of Sin, rolled up 10 feet. So I had a birdie putt. As I was walking up to the thing, I was quite chuffed with myself, obviously, as you can imagine. And I just heard the caddy say to the other three caddies, did you see that shot? Unbelievable. And I was like, yes, this is brilliant. And then there was probably about 30 people that were around the 18th green. And I had a birdie putt, which would have meant I was 5 or 6 shots under my handicap at the time to finish that round. And I three-putted from 10 feet.
Oh, you three-putted? What, top of the bogey? Fantastic.
I did give it a run at the hole both times. It went past the hole both times, burned the edge both times as well. But yeah, so I shot an 85 around the old course, which was, I was still chuffed to bits with that. It was phenomenal. But that would be my one bit that I'd relive.
I love that you...
I'd like to relive the putts.
So yeah, exactly. No, but I just love that. That tells me, again, you don't take your golf too seriously. Like, you remember the... So what was most memorable about that, the 100-yard chip with the 100?
Yeah, I would say that was... Yeah. You know, that was through that Valley of Sin, like the amount of times you've seen people get to... They hit their drive just short of it, didn't they?
Yeah.
And then they can't get the distance right on... Yeah, and it rolls back down into the Valley of Sin and all that kind of stuff. It's just such an iconic place for golf. I loved St Andrews as well. Like, as a place, it's such a cool...
There's something quite special about it, isn't there?
Yeah, it's really, really nice. So
steeped in
hopefully
golf.
I can go back there at some point.
Very nice. Well, Ben, thank you very much.
Thank you, mate.
It's been a pleasure having you, and thanks for your friendship and support.
Always, buddy, always.